plan my talks. I have some general theme which I just try to follow. But I was struggling today. Should I say anything about September 11th? Should I not? You know, what's my responsibility? Can I just gloss it over? Have people heard enough about it? Blah, 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 blah. That's what my mind was doing. But I didn't, I wanted to, when I'm with my mother, I often watch television as a kind of anthropologist, just to see, well, what is this culture feeling? And not that that's what the whole culture is feeling, CNN or whatever it might be, or Canadian National News, but I didn't want to get a sense of how, you know, this culture does it. This is my part of my history, so I want to be a part of that history. Because monastics, we don't, you know, we tend to live a kind of whole different cultural life, with a very special, live a special life, which isn't competitive. Well, we have competitive energies, but you can't get anywhere in monastic life. Anyone who wants to be CEO is seen as being stupid. Because it's, you know, you just kind of ordain, and that's where you are in the line for the rest of your life. So this, much of the energy that we have is a kind of different community-based kind of experience. This morning I was listening to those names being read out, name after name after name, and I was just trying to, I like to practice empathy, something I find very rewarding to do, to actually try to feel what other people feel. This is what empathy is about. So put aside my kind of discriminating mind and actually try to put myself in the other person's shoes. And of course, then that really brings forth either the sorrow or the joy, whatever it might be. And that's that practice of empathy is very basic to an understanding of the way of Buddhism, the practice of empathy. And empathy isn't sympathy. It's not like you, one is saying, oh, you, poor you, you've got a, you know, you've got a broken leg or something. It's actually trying to put oneself into that position to actually feel what the other is feeling. So it is a letting go of selfishness. It is very much entering into another person's psyche, which can be very painful. But it does facilitate good communication. It does really, because if I can somehow intuit where another person's coming from, even if they're being bloody-minded or whatever, if I can intuit that and feel that and know what that feels like, then I know what I'm communicating with. I know who I'm communicating with. There's true feeling, true sensitivity there. So, you know, just kind of listening to all that, and then I could, not enough of that, turn the thing off. And then I went for a walk in the experimental farm. Good time to go. Full of birds, because they're eating all the grain that's been left behind from the harvest. And there was a flock of pigeons, must have been 300-400. Couldn't resist, had to go in the middle of the field, of course, and they were flying around. And just this exquisite feeling of the beauty of nature, just the clouds and the blue sky and this canvas, the three-quarter sky, and you know, the beauty of all that. And that's also part of the open heart, isn't it? That I think if our hearts are truly open and empathetic to life, then we experience both. We experience the sorrow and the tragedy of, be it people in Afghanistan or people in New York City, whatever it is. But we also touch the joy of Algonquin Park and the pigeons in the experimental farm and the blue skies and so on. So it seems to me that's a very worthy thing to do, to both communicate with life, to appreciate life, to know life in a real full way. If we're rather caught up in our thoughts in a sort of a heedless way, then we're going to miss so much of life. And our communication can be miscommunication, and we'll miss a lot of beauty and so on and so forth. And the reflection on empathy is a universal reflection. I had this lovely experience when I was a younger fellow traveling around Europe, and I decided to go to Morocco, and I went to Morocco, and I was in one of those fantastic marketplaces in Morocco, and I had this insight that, oh, people are people. Because before that, I always thought, well, the third world is somehow different. I didn't know how. And I wasn't racist. It wasn't that kind. It was just sort of different. And then walking in the marketplace, you could see that some people were rip-offs, some people really kind, some people were neurotic, some people were peaceful, some people were happy, some unhappy, as human beings. That was a lovely insight. It really kind of really opened my heart that, you know, beyond Moroccans and Latvians and Canadians and so on, there's human beings. And that is the reflection on empathy, you know, that the Buddha was, I think, really trying to get us down to that human level of contact, beyond gender, beyond nationality, beyond age, just the human predicament, the human existence, the human experience. Because the critical mind, of course, needs to go, we need discernment. So in Morocco, I got ripped off enough times that I knew, you know, be careful. And that, you know, this guy may be nice, but he might take your passport. So there's also discernment. And I could take that open-hearted attitude and become very naive and silly. Please, yes, you can borrow my passport. And I did lose my passport once. So there's also discernment. You know, that's an important part of the human consciousness, isn't it? The ability to see, to understand people at a discernment level too. And that's the, you know, sort of the kind of heart and head dilemma, not dilemma, the heart and head experience that we have as human beings. Because part of our experience is the heart, and part is also, you know, seeing differences and being able to be critical and being able to analyze and being able to think skillfully. That's important too. So I found, like, you know, watching CNN or Canadian National News, I could see my heart kind of being very sorrowful about the whole, you know, just massive killing and the war and all these resources being used for, you know, for war and making guns, you know, all that, you know, how sad that makes the heart. And so the heart's kind of very, very open. And then the discriminating mind, yeah, what about Nicaragua and what about East Timor? All those Americans, you know, their foreign policy, blah, 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 blah. I mean, is it the kind of the way the heart and the mind sometimes work? And I'm pretty naive politically. You know, I read The Guardian, that's my sort of political left-wing view of life. But I know life is so very, very complex. And I just know running a monastery is difficult enough. I can't imagine running a country or a business or whatever. But we need both. We need to have discernment, and we need to have empathy. I think we need both. And when discernment becomes affected by racism and sexism and all these things, that it's no longer discernment, it's ignorance, isn't it? And I think the empathetic heart then, if that's what is our underlying relationship to the world, then when discernment becomes affected by the whole sense of an enemy, if I hate someone, right, what do I have to do? I have to create that person as other, you know, as being either stupid or incompetent or you know, some racial thing. I have to create other, don't I, to hate that person. But empathy, you can't do that, because empathy, what it does, it finds the commonality. You and I are brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death. You know, we want to be free from pain. We are born of mothers and so on and so forth. And I think that's why Buddhism really emphasizes the universality of compassion, but not as a naive thing, not in that way. But so I think that we have a standard of how we are relating to the world. So when these biases come up into the mind, the biases of hatred, the biases of greed, the biases of fear, that then distort our ability to discern, distort wisdom, that we are conscious of that. You know, and if we are conscious of that, then we have a better chance of making, of communicating better, of making better decisions. And not believing that mind, which is so alienated from ourselves and from life in general, from others. I know, yes, I know for myself, like, say, my parents, they come from Latvia, and I just, you know, Latvia is one of those border countries where big powers sweep through and knock the little guys around. So in 1939, the Germans came in, no, the Russians came in, sent a whole bunch of people to the Gulag. Then in 1940, the Germans come in, killed a whole bunch of people. Then in 1944, the Russians came in again, sent a whole bunch of people to the Gulag. This kind of sort of political history that I've been raised with, the political history of refugees, the political history of an oppressed country. And yet I could see that if say, Latvian people hate the Russians, that's not going to work. It's just not going to work. That they do, I mean, that does exist. But it's very easy then to create, say, a Russian. This is a Russian. This is a Russian, of course, implies all these kind of negative things. It's a Russian. Or, you know, the person is black, or that person is yellow, or that person is Chinese, or that person's a Latvian. You know, these kind of simplistic notions we have. And we do that with, like, Mr. Bush. You know, just the Mr. Bush with his policies and so on. But I was just trying to, like, just watch Mr. Bush and think, well, just try to be empathetic. It's hard. But it's important. You know, because, you know, here I go, political, I don't want to. But to try to see that part of humanity, too. Not to be naive, but to also have empathy for everyone. For everyone. For the Russians. For the guys who were in those planes, for the racists, for the pedophiles, for all these, you know, aberrant kinds of energies that we have in the world. Because it's very easy for the mind to kind of take very simplistic positions and lose the heart, lose the kind of empathetic heart. And then to use discernment from there. You know, then to use the critical faculty to see what is right and wrong from there, rather than from hatred. Because I think then, for me, that's where I make my best decisions. That's where I make... I know, just being an abbot of monasteries, I can... yeah, there's always the type of person who, like Ajahn Sumedho says, you've got a rowboat full of people. You know, everyone's working hard, rowing away in one direction, working hard, building, coming to the meetings on time. And then there's a character out back with his feet in the water, fishing line in the water, and just kind of, come on, get in line. So I, you know, like, just my own sense of aversions or criticism or judgment, how easy, once I take that position against a person, you know, this person's lazy, okay, then I don't see them as a human being. I see that memory. Oh, there goes lazy again. You know, here he comes, lazy. You know, and I create self and other. And it's very easy. It's very, very easy to do that. And yet, I have responsibility. So, like, I have responsibility to say, hey, come on. You know, you do have to row, too. You know, it's a part of your duty to come to the meetings and come to the work and so on and so forth. So I have responsibilities in the monastery. I have to train. Junior monks, and I have to admonish and so on and so forth. And if I just come from my own biases and prejudices, it's a mess, isn't it? It's just a mess. And then maybe someone agrees with my mess, and that's even more of a mess. And so you get scapegoats. You know, you get this in community. You get, you know, one poor person then gets scapegoated because everyone's a mess. And all of that, and so on and so forth. But if one comes back to the standard that this is a human being, this is a being who wants to be free from suffering, you know, no matter how aberrant the person is, at least from that, one can see, well, how much am I creating on top of this? How much am I dumping from my own jealousies or my own fears or my own pettiness or whatever? How much am I creating on that? It's a very good test. Because when there's aversion, you don't want to look at the common ground, do you? You know, like if I'm averse to lazy, Mr. Lazy, Monk Lazy, and then someone says to me, you know, he was really diligent. Oh, no, he wasn't. You don't want to hear that, do you? You know, when I'm really down on someone, I don't want to hear any praise about that person because I want my opinion to be, I'm right, and that guy's wrong, right? And if I get very defensive that way or very judgmental that way and I can't take that other kind of information, that's a strong sign. That's something I should be aware of. That's assumption, something I should be awake to. So what's the difference between aversion and discernment? There's a difference, isn't there? Discernment sees cause and effect. Aversion is a projection of something I don't like. Right? On a kind of emotional basis, isn't it? Well, there's a lot of things I don't like. Like, I don't like immorality. I don't like etc., etc. But how can I then use that critical faculty to create a better space in my community? So, correct admonishment. I read this last time, and I was reading it again, just to remind you. I'm sure you remember these 8 to 10 points. Before admonishing another monk, a monk shouldn't... This is from the Anguttara. Before admonishing another monk, a monk should investigate 5 conditions in himself and establish 5 other conditions in himself. He should investigate thus, am I one who practices purity in bodily action? Right, so do I keep the precepts? Have I got my act together on that level? Am I one who practices purity in speech? Is the heart of goodwill established in me towards my fellows? Am I one who has heard the teachings, practiced them, and penetrated them with insight? Is a discipline known and thoroughly understood by me? And he should establish these 5 conditions in himself. He should speak at the right time, speak of facts, and speak gently, and he should speak only profitable words and with a kindly heart. And now, that's it. You know, that's for community life. That's in a community where people are living by a kind of common standard. And maybe you can't do that if someone just, you know, crashed your car and is trying to get away without telling you their insurance number or whatever. But those kinds of reflections of personal responsibility before we spill the beans, I think are very sobering and give us pause. And pause is a very important thing, just to pause before I come down on the world in my own kind of self-righteous way. Next to this little bit is another nice one, the 7 qualities of a wholesome friend. This is the... You know, you hear this word kalyanamitta in Buddhism, wholesome friend. That individual is endearing, worthy of respect, cultured and worthy of emulation, a good counselor, a patient listener, capable of discussing profound subjects, and is one who never exhorts groundlessly, not leading or spurring one on to a useless end. Enduring, worthy of respect, cultured and worthy of emulation, a good counselor, a patient listener, capable of discussing profound subjects, and is one who never exhorts groundlessly, not leading or spurring one on to a useless end. It's a lot of work too, huh? But I was contemplating that last one, never exhorts groundlessly, not leading or spurring one on to a useless end. You know, how much of our talk is just sort of, isn't it an awful world talk? You know, we just kind of get into that whinge as human beings. And yeah, there's a lot of awfulness in the world, but this is kind of habitual speech where we just dwell on these kinds of things and we create this kind of, sometimes like racism or, you know, the other side, the enemy. And we really need to kind of guard against that in our own hearts, because it's a good excuse for aversion. It's really a nice kind of excuse to have a scapegoat, to have someone you hate. And as I like to say in Buddhism, we have we always talk about the teaching in two ways. We talk about the teaching in terms of social responsibility and social ethics, and that part of our being which is a social being, so our political side, our economic side, our moral side, and so on. And we talk about Buddhism as stream of consciousness, right? And in stream of consciousness, any amount of hatred that I entertain is going to make stream of consciousness more hateful, right? So as I was saying on that day of mindfulness, if I hate myself or I hate you, it's the same thing. I do violence to you, I do violence to myself, I'm putting more hatred into stream of consciousness. And if culture says there's some justifiable object of hate, like even to hate Mr. Bush, you know, you can, well, I can disagree with him, but to indulge, seems to me, to get a group of five people and just really hate Mr. Bush is putting in stream of consciousness hatred, which is affecting me and which is going to affect the, you know, my relationships. But it doesn't mean that I have, you know, I like him, I agree with his policies, etc., etc., etc. You know, I can say, no, this is wrong, or I can agree with him, whatever position you want to take. But then to take an object like that and justify hatred, you know, it's very easy to do, isn't it? Very easy to do. And you get five people, it's great fun. I'm sure you have Bush bashing, huh? Must be. Or whatever side to take, yeah? So not to be naive or dismissive of discernment, and to be educated, to democracy takes a lot of work. You're going to read a lot, and if you're going to vote, you have to know who candidates are, and so on and so forth. So it's not something that is just unlikely. It takes a lot of work, I think, a good democracy. But then to protect both our own hearts and others from this easy tendency just to hate the other, to make the enemy. You know, to make an enemy, you have to dehumanize them, don't you? So, like with the Jews in Auschwitz and so on, what do? They made them naked. They went into an interview, they were naked. So that Primo Levi, that book, If This Were a Man, a fantastic book, where he has to go see an officer, and he goes in naked. So, that, you know, kind of make him look like an insect. And this is what the human mind can do. It can dehumanize very easily the other, the enemy. So if you just took that part, you think, well, yeah, well, what about, what are you going to do about Stalin? What are you going to do about Hitler? What are you going to do about these awful beings, Pol Pot and so on? We do, but we have to do something. And so I don't have any answer to that. I don't have any answer to that. But can the decisions be made from wisdom, discernment, and human consciousness rather than enemy consciousness? Can they be made that way? Maybe no. I don't know. I met when I was in living. We lived in their retreat center in Oxford, and there was a hunter. He was a forester, and he had a cull of deer. Because when the deer population got too big, it had to be kept down because it was a limited size forest. So he loved hunting. He loved the chase. And he began to really feel for the animal. But as soon as he got the animal in his sights, usually an older one, he would have to put up a target in his mind, have to forget about the animal and just shoot the thing and kill it. It's the only way he could do it. And that's what the other does, isn't it? You know, when I have the other, then I just create something else, an image. But that creates me too. Because when I create other, I create self, and that creates a lot of fear. When I create you in a hateful way, then it creates me in a fearful way. Because I create separation and alienation. Notice how the two have to arise together. Self and other arise. Whereas when one has empathy, you get out of the way, don't you? You're like with these lovely pigeons. They just got out of the way. They just frolicked among the pigeons. I didn't fly. Or it's the Canada geese there. There are about 50 Canada geese and these lovely crows and so on. And you get out of the way with empathy. You're not there. You're not intruding with your judgments and comments and so on. Empathy has that quality. So I take the basis of my social life, and admittedly my social life is rather simple compared to the complexity of some of the things I saw on television, but I try to make the spiritual, my heart, flow of consciousness, the basis of part of my decision making. So if I have to do something in a monastery, I try to see, well, what is stream of consciousness doing now? Is it invested with centeredness? Is it invested with acceptance? Does it see the human situation? Or is it just got a strong sense of self and separation, alienation? And if that's very strong, I know, be careful. Because decisions and ideas and those kinds of things from that space are not going to be very constructive. So you can get kind of a New Age philosophy like, you know, Mr. Lennon in Montreal did that sit-in with Yoko Ono, I remember. Kind of all we were saying is give peace a chance, and somehow it'll all be nice, and so on and so forth. And then the whole energy of love seems so naive and hopeless. But we do have intelligence, and we have a certain amount of power, and each of us has a kind of capital. We have a kind of emotional capital, and we have a social capital. In other words, we influence people in a particular way. I influence people in a particular way. You influence people in a particular way, according to your family, to amount of power you have, where you work, right? So the amount we can do in the world depends on our capital. Right? So I have a certain amount of influence, and I try to use that, but that's how I can be socially active. I can be socially active in my monastery, in my culture, but only if I touch the human heart. If I'm not aware of the human heart, how can my activism really be invested with any wisdom? You know, if I just come from opinions and views and biases and so on, there's not going to be any depth in that kind of the way I function in society. When I was in University of Toronto, I was there during when the Chicago 7 were on trial, which was the time of Vietnam and Kent State and all these difficult things in the 60s. And there was a guy called Jerry Rubin, one of the Chicago 7, and he was giving a talk at Convocation Hall. No, it was some other hall. Anyway, maybe they wouldn't even let him on campus, but wherever it was, there were about 300 or 400 people, and this really radical, what do they call them then? Not hippies, but yippies. He came on stage with a Viet Cong flag around his shoulders, and he was the most, he really amazed me at his demagoguery. I was just stunned by the power he had to make everyone angry. He was absolutely brilliant, but I found it frightening. And you'd see how his energy was very clever, and it was very, very self-righteous, and the energy there was very exhilarating, but it was very violent. It was very self-righteous. And it quite frightened me. It really, really frightened me. And I think of Ajahn Chah, the way he operated in his culture. He's a very powerful being. He's a kind of a shogun in his culture. Really, really understood his culture. Had a lot of power because of the respect great teachers have in Thailand. And used that power in a brilliant way, in an absolute brilliant way. We started up... Funny story, got to change, it's getting heavy here. We had this monastery we stayed in, a very interesting experience actually. When Ajahn Sumedho, who was Ajahn Chah's senior Western disciple, had been a monk for about 8 years, he was invited to start a monastery near the main monastery, near Wat Phat Phong. And it was called Ban Bung Wai, was the name of the village, and the monastery was very successful very quickly. And it was a fascinating experiment because it was a group of non-Thai monks, Americans and Canadians and Australians and so on, Englishmen, that were trying to set up a traditional monastery in a Thai village society. So our duties were as monks, but we weren't from that culture. And it was very successful, a very popular place. Now, one of the neighboring monasteries, there start to be these notes dropped around about all kinds of accusations against the Western monks, that we were this and we were that, and I won't tell you the accusations. But they were very, very strong and sort of disgusting kind of notes that were being dropped around everywhere. And lo and behold, the person that was doing this was the abbot of a neighboring monastery. There was only two monks there, of course, but he got busted dropping one of these notes. And so the villagers were in an uproar, you know, disrobe the guy and get rid of him and he's a disgrace and all of this. So they asked Ajahn Chah to arbitrate. And so Ajahn Chah came, I don't know, a week later or something, and the monk was sort of asked to come into this kind of big village council. And you could see that everyone was really up for blood. They were really enjoying it. You know, we got a victim now, you know, and oh, it was awful, it was terrible, you know, self-righteousness, and you wonder what everyone else is doing in the background, but yeah, let's lynch him. I mean, there was no physical violence involved, but the energy was very, very self-righteous, very much that. And Ajahn Chah saw all this, he said, forgive him. Everyone knows what he did. He made a complete fool of himself. He's going to suffer the rest of his life with this. Forgive the man. You know, what's all your, you know, vengeance going to do? And they forgave him. And he went back to the monastery, and they fed him, and hopefully learned something. But I thought it was such a brilliant use of leadership. You know, here was this kind of possibility of becoming very self-righteous and so on. But it was just okay, that's a kind of minor incident compared to these major things. But it was just kind of the use of one being who knew his power, who knew his capital, as it were, and knew his society. I knew how to use that in a very skillful way for the good of the culture. Because it was a great lesson. You know, it was a really, really brilliant lesson. We had another one. It's one I often talk about where Ajahn Chah used to sit under his... He had a hut on stilts. And the bottom floor was open, kind of terrazzo floor, and he would receive guests. Under his hut there in the shade. And he had a large ledger beside him, and if anyone wanted to make donations to the monastery, they would just put it in the ledger, because we monks don't handle money. And then the accountant would come at the end of the day, and he would take the money and put it in the bank, and then that would be used for the expenses of the monastery. But one day, I don't know how it was known, but someone had stolen 1,000 baht. So the big bell was rung, and we were all called together, and Ajahn Chah said, listen, someone has stolen 1,000 baht from the ledger book. Now, I don't know if the person's here, so everyone who was in the monastery was gathered, but if that person's here, I'd like to give him a chance to change your karma. So everyone go back to your hut and make yourself a package, cover it in paper or whatever. That would look about 1,000 baht package. I forget how he said it. So we went all back and then bring it to the main bell tower. And then there were 3 senior monks in the main bell tower who'd receive all this, and when they're all collected, then and everyone was gone, then they would open them up and see if 1,000 baht was there. So I went back to our huts, wrapped the stuff up, brought a little packages, gave them to the senior monks, went back, and then senior monks opened them. They didn't find the money. But what, I mean, what really impressed me is we didn't get a lecture on stealing. You know, there was compassion. You know, he really felt, well, if someone in the monastery, a monk, has been so stupid to do this. Because in our rules, if a monk steals, he's done. He's out. He doesn't even have to disrobe. He's no longer a monk. So a monk would have, you know, that's it. It's called a defeat offense. But anyway, I mean, what really struck me was how well he handled that. And it was kind of really brilliant leadership on setting an example. And I thought, oh, here we go, a lecture on the second precept. You know, thou shalt not, you know. Because we all know that already. So there, you know, that. So here is a man that had a lot of capital, even though he didn't own much, but he had a lot of capital. He had a lot of power in his own culture, and he used that very, very well. So each of us has a little bit of capital. So people who have a lot of power and may have even more capital in terms of influence, and that's where we can work. And that's kind of, I guess, act locally, think globally. Is that the idea? Yeah. And that's important, isn't it? Because if I affect you in some way, which is wholesome, in a wholesome stream of consciousness, then our society has that underpinning. But also, it protects my own mind. And this is the beauty of I think any spiritual teaching, that by protecting my own heart from following unskillful impulses, I also protect society. You know, it's not either or. Sometimes people think, well, it's either or, but it's not really. If you're looking at stream of consciousness, at what your mind is producing, and you realize that if I function or speak or act from delusion, then that's going to be my karma. I'm going to get more of that in the future. So if I dump my aversions on Mr. Lazy, you know, it's not just about that. It's in the future that I'm going to get lazy, you know, that aversion is going to be compounded. So then I see someone else, well, another lazy one, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. And that's the beauty of the practice of awareness. When one is really sensitive and aware and empathetic perhaps to one's own being, you know, and this is where self-empathy is important, not self-indulgence, oh poor me, I'm angry again, not that, but really having empathy for your own karma, you know, that I suffer from anger, that I suffer from jealousy, suffer from fear. These are things that are part of my you know, I guess there's capital and there's luggage. Right? So that's part of the baggage, okay? And that's what I have to learn from and understand. And that's self-empathy. Self-empathy is saying, okay, there is this tendency to be very judgmental or very dismissive or fearful or whatever. Okay, that's something I'm going to work on this lifetime. That's self-empathy. And if you're looking at stream of consciousness, if there's self-empathy, well, I won't indulge in that, but I'll know, all right, I've got to work with that. You know, there's something to be done here, which is different than aversion. Aversion to my own so-called failings is not self-empathy. It's not wisdom. It's not awareness. It's just another trip. Another kind of judgmental trip I put on myself. So emotionally, empathy is the kind of underpinning of I think, true understanding of ourselves and others. And then discernment, the ability to see cause and effect, is where we can use thought skillfully, both in social settings, both in our own meditation practices, or whatever experience. Both are very important. So we say, Panya and Metta, or Panya and Karuna, these factors of mind, the right use of thought. Because thought's very important, thought's very powerful. The right use of thought, but based on empathy. Thought not just driven by delusion, because that's a disaster. And also the heart, not just driven by sentimentalism, by some kind of naive hope that everything will be fine if I just love everyone. You know, there is work to be done. There's committee meetings to go to, there are things to organize, and so on and so forth. So both are very important. All right, I'll leave that for tonight. Any questions or comments from anyone? Mm-hmm.
had some observations. The meditation practice that we did at the beginning with the may I be well, may you be well, and start with a, then move to a person to try to visualize and send out and proceed towards them. I found it was interesting today that I, last time I did this, I was finding it hard to feel empathy. And then I found that if I tried to think of the difficulties that the person had, then something started happening.
Right.
But then what I find is, as I try to spread that, I start thinking a lot, and then I go right off, and I'm no longer with that.
Yeah, it goes into the head.
Yeah.
Well, what I try to do is I try to get a trigger for the heart. So I don't need much now because I've developed a lot of that, but I'll just try to pick up the image of a person that it's easy for me to have an open-hearted feeling towards them. And then I'll just try to generate that. Quite often I won't even use other people. See, once that's there, I know what that feeling's like. So it is very important not just to go into thought. So it's just enough thought, maybe just the name of the person, the image, or just a memory, to trigger the openness of the heart. And then how can I keep cultivating that? Sometimes just by feeling it, breathing, and then maybe triggering the memory again just a little bit. Because really, if you have compassion for one person, you have it for everyone, because compassion is compassion. These are just the conceptual kind of language you use. But there's also joy. You can think of the pigeons. You know, because the heart also opens to memories of joy and beauty. So you can remember Elizabeth showed me a lovely picture of someone going off to war and holding their child, and the child had their hand up to the father's face. This is a beautiful kind of loving image. Just that, you know, just bring up that kind of loving image as a memory, and then just connect to the heart, and you've got it. You're there. And then see how one can keep that going. I use pictures a lot. So like one of my joy images is a picture of Santana I saw in The Guardian. I used to really like Santana. And he had just, there's a color picture of him having won these 4 or 5 Grammys. And there's a great picture of him with, I think, a Miles Davis t-shirt, his guitar and like that. And it was such a happy picture. So do that. Because the heart connects actually very easily. We just sometimes don't notice it. But and then once you get a feeling for the heart, you'll see how you go into head all the time, how thought goes, you know, how when you think too much about the person, the storyline, or get critical. And once you kind of see that, you've got a way of knowing when to think, but also knowing when thinking is not appropriate, and how to stay down here more. And you have a lovely way of intuiting life from a different level than just the head level. I think you use both. Yeah? Okay. Any others? Anyone? Joanna, you said you saw me walking. You said you had the ultimate question.
Yeah, but that would be a private question. I'm not sure that the other one
okay.
suggested. However, I have another one. So you answered for this one that I wanted.
Okay.
But I was just wondering when you were saying that cultivating this beautiful thing at the moment when I was doing the meditation, I really felt really, really good, and just really attentive to me, but it felt real good. And I thought, okay, this is it, you know, this is the, and I was picturing everybody. And you just mentioned that, you know, like, open the heart and cultivate that. But at the same time, what came to my mind is, this feels good, but you also say, let's don't think it's good. So what would be the difference between cultivating it and trying to sustain it, but at the same time, not thinking it? What's the difference between that?
Yeah, it's kind of like knowing your breath, knowing your breathing. It's always there. It's just like if you if you develop just a breath awareness in ordinary life, you know, you're driving a car, or you're, especially if you're running or doing sport or you're cooking, and you get a kind of second level of consciousness going on the breath, you're not clinging to it, you just know that it's breathing. You also get that with the heart. The more you pay attention to it, and the more you are, the more you develop awareness of that, the more you know it. So it's not so much that one is seeking a kind of pleasant experience. One just realizes one aspect of consciousness that sometimes we aren't attentive to until there's something extreme. Sometimes we notice it when someone we really love or some deep sorrow, but it's more like it's there all the time. Just like in the breath, you might only notice it when you're running or when you walk up some stairs. So now we're refining our awareness so that we see that the, well, I do, that the heart is a very sensitive area and has a way of showing us things. So it's not just about kind of a pleasant feeling, it's deeper than that. Maybe it's not a useful tool for you. Maybe, you know, some people are too sensitive, I don't know. But it certainly is a useful tool for me. But I also, like all day today, I felt a lot of kind of anxiety down in my guts. Just from, because I guess I'm human. Sorry. profound statement, right? But that, you know, where's that? Where's that in the body? And not to take it to thought. And that's not pleasant. That's not pleasant. But that, yeah, okay, that's a part of being here now in this situation. And allowing that to be, then I'm both aware of my own reactions to the world and my own karma. So it's a different place to be aware than just thought. Thoughts are good. I mean, thoughts are important. But... Nalini?
The question reminded me that yours for Bringdang.
Huh? Bringdang. You got to get your tie right, huh? Prung Dang, yeah.
As long as there's no pain, then.
Prung Dang. Yeah, that's it, you get it? Prung Dang means to season and to dress up in Thai.
Really? Oh. I thought it had to do with creating a storyline.
But the imagery comes from. Prung means when you take some veggies, put a lot of spices and sauces in them, you prung it. And dang tua means when you kind of go out in town and get really dressed up and put everything on. So it's a great image for metal proliferation. Prung dang, yeah. But that's in thought. You know, you can't prung dang with a heart. I can't. Yeah, you can observe it, right. Yeah. Yeah. That's actually how we talk, the monks who have been in Thailand. We kind of, it's great language. We throw in, like, or a Pali too, Pali Thai, we get make it into verbs and so on. It's great fun. Any others? Anyone? what? Maybe. Yes.
I think it's fascinating talking about how, as a result of the pandemic, there has been sort of a more pervasive enemy, sort of consciousness. And I also realized that I'm experiencing it sort of closer to home, too. But, well, my background is Jewish. Everybody in my family is just a very new kind of consciousness to be Palestinian. And I find myself not knowing when to deal with that because it's so different from my own kind of way of viewing the world or feeling it. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about how to deal with other people who are in that sort of enemy.
Well, the more you can stay centered in your heart, the better better chance you have to give a response which is profound rather than passionate, right? But you have to wait your turn. You have to bide your time. And you don't know. You never know. But if you know how to stay with the heart, stay centered, there do come spaces where something profound can come forth, with it, which isn't just reactive passion or trivialization or, you know, dismissive, you know, those kinds of things aren't profound. Dismissive statements or trivial statements or whatever, they just come, they're a kind of counter-reaction. So to put something profound into such passionate talk takes a lot of centeredness and biding your time, feeling the wanting to just bounce back with a retort. And knowing your own power in that situation, knowing your capital there, as it were, these kinds of things. And that, I think, only comes from allowing the situation to evolve, maybe warning yourself beforehand, say, okay, I'm going to use this conversation to watch my heart, rather than I'm going to get in there and I'm going to change the direction of the conversation. Because if you get that right, then there's more chance that the what comes out will be more right. But they are, you know, because we're sensitive people, we get pulled by that stuff. We get really, really pulled and influenced. Yeah, it is. Yeah, both for them and for you. I mean, for everyone. Yeah, and it's all kind of justifiable at some thought level. You know, it all can be explained. And once people start getting on that, there's no dialogue anymore. There's no listen. That's it. People don't listen anymore. That's the hard thing. You know, it's just two opinions kind of bashing each other. And when there's no listening, then oftentimes you have to back off. You just have to. Because to drop something profound into a discussion, there has to be some listening. And that, yeah, some respect. So, yeah, it's a lot of that. What else? Anything else? Anyone in the bleachers there? Oh, sorry. Yes.
I came back from a trip to Thailand and quite saddened from something that I experienced there, and wanted to comment on it. And my experience was that those people who had genetic physical disabilities had acquired physical disabilities through accidents and their many motorcycle accidents in Thailand. But these people were basically shunned in the experience that I had, and were talking to educators and also to students as well. And in a country which is almost mostly Buddhist, which professes compassion and empathy.
Well, Buddhism is a nominal. It's a social label rather than a profound religious view for many people. So you get like, who was it? The police of Chiang Mai were smuggling heroin from Burma down into Bangkok and out. And the army had to bust the police. You know, how does that fit Buddhism, right? So you get a tremendous amount of corruption in Thailand, and it doesn't gel at all. It has nothing to do with teaching, obviously. So there's a lot of mouthing, a lot of hypocrisy of, you know, what the teaching is. So you get, and even, you know, monasticism is a tremendous amount of corruption that goes on there. So it's not justifiable. It's human delusion, human ignorance. So what you find in Thailand, you find like pockets, like say Ajahn Chah, a very good monastery. But then around that, there was a lot of corruption too, you know, in monasticism and so on. So it's just one of the sad things of that culture. You know, there's child prostitution, there's, you know, all that corrupt, very, very corrupt, very sensual. And yet you have these like Ajahn Chah and Mahabhu, really profound teachers who teach very high teaching. So, yeah. The reason a lot of Western monks have kind of not stayed in Thailand is that they've decided it's just too difficult to live there because of all that. Yeah. So I have no answer to it really. It's like any culture, it takes on, you know, religion just becomes a kind of cultural norm rather than a true profound or even superficial keeping. Like the five precepts are so obvious in Buddhism, and yet what goes on there, you know, so much against the five precepts. Yeah, Ajahn Chah was, you know, kind of, he was quite brave, you know, trying to kind of struggle against some of that kind of corruption that he saw. Yeah, so don't have an answer. But you have to separate what the teaching of the Buddha is and what a culture does with it. And then just take from the teaching that which is profound. And from the culture of that which is good. I was fortunate because I lived in a village culture which was very, very poor, and where the monastery had a lot of power in the village culture, that was still functioning, where, like, television hadn't come yet, electricity hadn't come, and there was a kind of, there was alcoholism and so on going on, but there was still a power with the religion because of the powerful teachers around there. But even since I've been in Thailand, even that's been eroded a lot. So the area where Ajahn Chah is now is rife with amphetamines. It's just an endemic plague of amphetamine use. In these villages, which I couldn't believe it. You know. So what happened in the village culture was a lot of people went to Bangkok to make money, and then they came back and brought a lot of Bangkok habits into the villages once the education went. So it's very tragic, very, very sad. The king is the kind of, he's the conscience of the nation, and he tries to kind of create moral values, but there's a tremendous amount of corruption. What else? Any others?
But in the day of mindfulness, you said something about you were answering somebody, and it wasn't your main point. So it was sort of in between, and then went on to something else. But about overwhelm, and it's almost always better to get away than overwhelm.
Uh-huh.
Get out of it.
Yeah.
And I think you were talking more about overwhelm of angry feelings. But there's overwhelm of all kinds.
Yeah.
Overwhelm at work or anything. I just want to say more about getting out of it, or not necessarily. Is this what you were really referring to?
Well, if some condition of suffering is so overwhelming that you can't be mindful of it, be it fear or anger, whatever, then because I can't be mindful in it, I'm just going to make it stronger in the mind. So I'm going to be kind of reacting through it rather than have any space around it. The only way you can work in Buddhism is through awareness. So typically, when a person gets really, really, really overwhelmed, they have a nervous breakdown. It's a classic, isn't it? Because their whole nervous system is just can't take it anymore. So if you're in a situation where, you know, the heart is just reactive, then as much as possible get out of there, because you're both creating more karma in a social sense, but also in the mind sense. And then to dig yourself out of that hole takes more time. All of us have had that, where we've had to, you know, function from being totally burnt out, and you just have to keep functioning, but then the cost is, you know, it really takes a long time to recover. So it's that, the necessity. So like, say, one of the big debates is around depression, and people say, well, should you take drugs which are mood changers or not? And I don't know, but I've certainly met people who say they couldn't practice mindfulness until they took some mood changes. And then at least it was workable. life wasn't fun, but at least it was workable. So my, you know, awareness is the sort of starting point of what I talk about. Kind of, you know, to really understand heart and mind, you have to be aware. So if you're getting overwhelmed, you can't be aware. And then what are the strategies to sort of regroup the energies? And that's also an aspect of samadhi. Sama samadhi is when you're not overwhelmed by hindrances such as fear or anger. They might be there, but you're not overwhelmed by them. You know? So you have some strength of mind to watch them. Now, if you have strength of mind, if you have centeredness, then if anger comes up, your buttons get pressed. Well, then it's the other. It's a chance to purify the heart. Something triggers your heart. You start to think in anger. I'll just sit that through. And then the tendency towards anger gets liberated from the heart and mind. So it's the other. So it's not to live in some kind of a padded cell where you never have any kind of challenges. You know, challenges are very helpful, but challenges which are where you can be aware. That's what I refer to. Because I certainly, you know, I went through that in England where I just get overwhelmed by the complexity of the situation, and I just get myself in a deeper and deeper hole. Which is a good lesson on one level, but it took a long time to straighten to get gray matter around and all of that.
If I can ask a bit more of it, because I'm having a hard time seeing what the difference is with overwhelm in the sense of emotions.
Yeah.
And overwhelm, and I almost say emotional physical, where I'm thinking more about work, and I'm overwhelmed with the amount of work or responsibility or whatever it is. And I think I've brought myself into it. But they're very connected, and I can't see the connection. So I can see that if that is creating an emotion, that I sit with that. But I can't even identify the emotion. I just feel overwhelmed.
Well, the more exhausted you get, you know, the more your emotions just get triggered, don't they? Mm-hmm. So one conditions the other, and the more you trigger your emotions, the more you're going to work in a kind of frenetic way, which means, you know, one is, it's really mind-body is kind of working together. We all have that. We get exhausted, we have the flu, and everyone's like, shut up, leave me alone, give me some space, or whatever it is. So we all have that. Do you have a time of day where you can stop? You know, like during morning and evening, is there a time of stopping? Can you approach the day in some kind of centered way? And sometimes life is just like that, and you just have to survive, don't you? You know, it's just that way, but that can't be a lifestyle. It can't be a spiritual lifestyle, just sort of running on a treadmill. Because you do need space to contemplate the mind.
So, yeah, and that's it, you're contemplating the mind, that is, the state of the mind is being created by the overwhelm.
Yeah, well, you always have to do that.
Breaking it down and watching.
You always have to do that, no matter, you know, whether you've got space or not. But if you're just reactive, you won't do much mm-hmm. contemplation. No? You'll be all button. Not only, you know, they won't just press your button; you'll be just one big button. Reactive. Anyone else? Is that enough? No. Okay. I'll be going back to New Zealand on Monday via Kamloops. So, nice that you all came. Thank you for everyone's kindness to me. People treat me very, very well here. I shall be back early February.